Well, the final exam, if you opt to take the in-class final exam, it's next Wednesday, May 3rd, 1 to 3 p.m. here in the same old room. And I thought I'd have office hours next week, Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, 2 to 3. If you had any last-minute questions or wanted to talk about anything, Thursday would be after the exam, so that'd be after the fact. And for the exam, it'll be like the first midterm where I bring you paper and an exam sheet, and all you need to bring are pencils and erasers. But you're allowed this time a 1 2-sided handwritten crib sheet. So handwritten instead of laser printed and microscopic. I want you to handwrite it, so they'll all be the same. And of course, it's closed book, closed notes, and no calculators or any kind of electronics. So let's see, I thought I'd just put out a list of the topics that we've covered and the kind of things you can compute and do in a quick exam-like setting. Solving the vibrating string problem. I solved it at length pi in the beginning, but you need to know how to do it from length L. So it's pretty much the same Sturm-Liouville problem, it's just some minor variations. So the whole method of separation of variables, you need to understand and how to do it and be able to, say, summarize it if I ask you to summarize how you do it. And also, after we solve the string problem with separation of variables in Fourier series, then we did it again using D'Alembert's method. So you should also know how D'Alembert's method works and how to you don't have to do the proof that we did of D'Alembert's method, but sort of the basic idea and how to do it. How to use the thing to solve the wave equation. So let's see, we did Fourier series in two different forms. On the interval minus pi to pi. First, we did it using trig functions. In fact, first I did Fourier sine series. But then that led to the full Fourier series involving cosine and sine terms. So you'd need the formulas for those coefficients, the a's, and also in the complex form. Slightly different formulas, but they're equivalent. And you need to know sort of the facts of Fourier series and what do they converge to when they converge. So if a function is nice, it converges to the function. And if a function has a jump, it converges to the midpoint of a jump. Facts like that. And the basic facts that we proved about convergence of Fourier series, like if a thing is C2 smooth, then the coefficients are bounded by 1 over n squared, constant times 1 over n squared. And that makes all these series absolutely convergent and uniformly convergent to a continuous function. Facts like that. The proofs of those facts involving the Dirichlet kernel and that kind of thing is not something I'm going to ask you about on this kind of exam. That's just something you did in the homework, and that was difficult, time-consuming thing to do, even with hints from Stein. So I don't think I'll ask you that kind of questions, but computing and using the facts in basic ways are things I can do. It's important to know that the Fourier series gives you the best L2 approximation among trig polynomials of that degree to the function. So that's an important fact to know, and it's used a lot. And something to write down on your crib sheet is Parseval's formula. That related the sum of the squares of the Fourier coefficients to an integral. It's easy to ask questions about that kind of thing on a written exam, because it's just a matter of knowing the formula and what to do with it. So we have Parseval's theorem for Fourier series. When you don't know their Fourier series and don't know the thing is complete, the best thing you can get is Bessel's inequality when the sum of those functions is just orthogonal. So you need to know Bessel's inequality also. So a related fact to the Parseval's theorem was Fayer's theorem about the density in the continuous functions of trig polys. At least knowing the statement of that is important. Not necessarily the proof, where we use the Fayer kernel and, you know, the property of good kernels. I'm not going to ask you about proofs of that kind of thing. But knowing the facts would be nice to know. So remember, even on the first midterm, you did a geometric sum that was related to calculating what the Dirichlet kernel was. So things that are where you calculate e to the inx as a geometric series, we've done stuff like that before. So I wouldn't ask you do it for the Dirichlet kernel or the Fayer kernel, but maybe something related would be an important thing to know how to do. Let's see, I mentioned facts about convergence for Fourier series. You might want to brush up on what those were like. I'm going to ask you to compute things. It's hard to come up with a calculation that's not horrifically difficult. I mean, even when you did x squared times something on an interval, you had to integrate by parts twice, and it was kind of messy. So the most difficult integral I could ask you to probably calculate would be one involving x times a trig function, which would involve integration by parts only once. And you'd have to know how to do it even when this thing over here is complex, e to the inx. Of course, if you forget how to do it when it's complex, you can always split it into real and imaginary parts and do it twice. Let's see, the Fourier transform. You need to know the basic facts about Fourier transform, like, you know, what happens when you take the Fourier transform of a translation, what happens when you take the Fourier transform of a dilation of a function. Those are the basic facts. And remember the space S of Schwarz functions. So we had facts about the Fourier transform on Schwarz functions. That's the only case. That's where we mainly studied Fourier transform. And so one important fact was the Poincaré identity, namely that the Fourier transform preserves the L2 norm. That's like the Parseval identity, but for Fourier transform, it's that the L2 norm of the transform is the same as the L2 norm of F. That's another thing that, when it comes to calculations, is a thing to keep in mind, is the great simplifications that happen when a function is odd or even. So keep that in the back of your head, that could be something to think about to simplify matters. Also, you know, if I give you the Fourier sine series for something, that's a Fourier series, even though the Fourier sine series was on 0 pi. So let's see, if you're thinking about even and odd functions, something to keep in mind is that the Fourier sine series on 0 pi is the Fourier series for the odd extension. To minus pi pi. Stuff like that. And there were similar things for the Fourier transform. Let's see, one thing we used the Fourier transform that was computational was for solving the heat problem on R using the Fourier transform. What did I say? Solving the heat problem on R with the transform, and we did it on finite intervals using Fourier series. And that's where various Sturm-Liouville problems would come up. So you've probably seen enough Sturm-Liouville problems to know how they always come out, but the basic idea of finding non-zero solutions that only happen when there's certain values of the lambda involved. But that's the kind of place where Sturm-Liouville problems come up, because in a heat problem, there's different kinds of boundary conditions. On a string problem, the string is nailed down at the ends. It makes the boundary conditions simple. But on a heat problem, you could have an insulated end or a radiative end, and that leads to different Stern-Liouville problems. And another topic we covered, it's hard to come up with exam questions about it, but harmonic functions and solving the Dirichlet problem. So I could only ask you kind of rudimentary questions about solving the Dirichlet problem. And another thing we did was the maximum principle and how it relates to the averaging property. So I would call those are the big topics that, of course, I'm not going to test all of them, but they're the topics that were sort of the highlights of the course, and the ones topics where you can do computational things. I think I have a reasonable exam made up. I'm not going to ask you to do any proofs or anything too wild or crazy. There might be a couple of problems where you got to think a little while, but I'm not expecting anybody to get 100% on the exam. And I think I mentioned that you can improve your score by taking this in-class final, but you can't bring your score down from the previous one I gave you. So I'll post this list on the aftermath, if you want it. Any questions about anything? Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, what exactly is like the grading scheme like? How can this improve it exactly? Like,
well, let's see. If you take the written exam, and you do better, then I'll average it into the total score, in your typical scale. So I'd say if you do really well on this thing, you could increase your scale, but your grade by a half a step. If you really ace it, who knows? I'd have to look at the averages and see. You could maybe go up a whole step if you super ace it. Yeah. Other questions? Well, I did promise I wanted to talk about grad school, because I think a lot of you in here are, if you're juniors, you're going to be applying to grad school in the fall, and if you're seniors, you probably already got yourself, I heard a couple of you are going to do grad school, study physics, and stuff like that. Anyway, I was the graduate chair in math for 8 years, and I've read thousands of applications, so I kind of know, and I know what I'm looking for in applications when I see them. And so I would say that if you're doing math, it'll be very important to take the GRE math subject test, probably early in the fall. It's not offered very often, and a lot of schools require it, and even schools that don't require it look at it. So it's an important thing to do. If you wait till spring, you're probably too late because you need to take it in the fall. And sometimes it's a funny exam. It measures how much you've seen in a lot of ways. So a person with a master's degree typically aces that exam, whereas undergraduates maybe don't ace it, depending on, unless they've taken graduate courses as undergrads, like some of you have, then it's possible to ace it. But that is a funny exam. Sometimes it measures the quality of the program more than it measures the potential of the student. So very common for undergrads from, say, small colleges in North America to do kind of poorly on it. They could have very high GRE scores, like analytical and quantitative. And then a funny thing in grad school, verbal is actually a pretty strong indicator that you can write a thesis in reason. So you think that math nerds only need to do good in quantitative and analytical, but verbal is a good indicator that you're going to do good in graduate school, because writing math is a writing skill, that's for sure, and understanding, nitpicky arguments. So very often when I would notice a student from a small college who got very high GRE scores, meaning they had a lot of talent, but they kind of bombed the subject test. And it meant they weren't exposed to enough math at a high enough level. And so places like Purdue, I would take a chance on somebody that, because we have these courses that are called bridge courses, that if someone's background is a little bit weak, they spend the first semester taking a bridge course in real analysis and abstract algebra. And a good student like that, who from a small place who didn't see enough math, can very quickly catch up and be successful in our graduate program. Fancier places, like Ivy League schools, don't mess around with remedial things, and they probably wouldn't accept somebody with that profile. A low GRE math subject test is probably the kiss of death. If you're applying to, say, Princeton. Princeton is a weird school. Princeton, they used to not even teach the first year graduate courses there. They expected you to somehow pick those up along the way. But that book by Stein, they decided they better change their ways, and they started teaching this sequence of very high-powered first-year courses, where they do a whole lot in that first year. Those four books of Stein are supposed to be your first year of analysis in grad school. It's a pretty mind-blowing. So you have to have seen a lot of that if you could swallow that in 1 year with Stein. Yeah, so in physics, I presume there's a physics subject test, and I don't know, computer science maybe also, so it'll be important to do those. They're a funny exam because you can take it more than once if you want, and when I looked at scores, I only looked at the last or the highest last score, so it happens that sometimes that somebody bombed it, and you know, the math one asks a lot of questions about multivariable calculus like Stokes' theorem and Green's theorem and vector calculus. And people who are rusty on that bombed it. I was actually an engineering undergrad who took a lot of electromagnetism and physics, and so I did well on that part because it's just physics and electromagnetism things and doing the Gauss's theorem and that kind of thing. But if you're rusty on that, you could bomb the test. And so people find out they're rusty on that, and then they study some more and take it again and get a much better score. You can do that. That's why it's important to give it a shot early, so that if you do need to take it again, you can. And doing poorly on it does not mean you won't get into graduate school. There's some graduate schools that don't pay much attention to it. Yeah.
So like, how early can you take the GRE?
I'm gonna be surprised if you can take it in August, and then.
No, I'm saying can like a sophomore take it, and then like it's
the
still
GRE.
And you're like,
they decay. They expire after a certain number of years. I don't think I'd mess around taking the GREs until I was
for, like,
junior. For practice, it's a good thing to do. It costs money. I think you can get practice exams on the web from the educational testing services to practice on. I knew people who were practicing bubbling as fast as they could. Just so they... Because like the vocabulary test is excruciating. It's important to do adequately on those things, but your letters of recommendation can overrule any weakness in your file. For example, let's say you bomb the GRE subject test. Well, if you have very strong letters of recommendation from somebody, it can override that kind of a defect in your file. If you're going to be a senior next year, it's going to be important to get letters of recommendation from faculty who have taught you advanced courses in your subject. So math, that would be your senior level math major kind of honors courses. Those letters carry the most weight. If you liked your freshman calculus thing in class and you aced it and your instructor remembers you, they'll write you a nice letter, but it won't be a very meaningful letter. I mean, you could be the best student in Math 161 and it wouldn't carry much weight. So I would say those later classes are important. If you've taken a graduate level course in math or whatever your subject is, then that kind of letter can carry a lot of weight. I was an engineering undergrad at Michigan, but I was taking I took a couple graduate classes in complex analysis and real analysis, and the letters I got from those two people got me into MIT probably, because I have a feeling my file wouldn't have looked that great because I was strictly, I had no class in abstract algebra. So I was a very unusual type of math. I wasn't a math major, I was an engineering major. So So probably if I hadn't had the letters from somebody saying, hey, I'm operating at the level of a graduate student right now, I wouldn't have gotten into MIT. At least that's what Michael Arden told me, that my letters, yeah. He was the grad chair at MIT when I went.
I don't know why he blabbed it.
He wrote one of them, yeah, wonderful algebra book. He's the son of Emil Arden.
Yeah.
Emil Arden wrote the book on Galois theory, but Arden wrote a big textbook on algebra. Yeah, so he blurted out that it was my letters that got me in. I think it's also important to write, be very careful about writing your statement of purpose. When I was a graduate chair here, I read those very carefully because you've got to be very motivated to do graduate study in say, math, because it's a lot of work, and you got to like it or it's going to be agony. You know what I mean? Especially when you write a thesis. If you don't like what you're thinking about, then it's really hard to sit around and think. Because a lot of math research is you sit around and think and don't get anything. And that can be discouraging. You sort of have to like the challenge and like persevering and live for that feeling of the breakthrough. Not everybody has those the enthusiasm for that. And sometimes you can tell from a person's statement of purpose that they sort of have the right take on math and what they like about it. If they say, I just want to get a PhD because my uncle has a PhD, or I want to get a PhD because I want to get a high-paying job, that's not the kind of thing that grabs me when I was selecting students. I want to hear somebody who had a passion for some area of math and, you know, give me a convincing reason why they want to do it for their living. And, you know, there's people who want to do, who know they have to do a little bit of research to get a PhD, but it's the passion for research and understanding math at a deep level that I like to hear. So I don't know if Arden didn't say anything about my statement of purpose, but anyway, I had been exposed to the Gödel incompleteness theorem, and it kind of blew my mind, and so I wrote about what I liked about it, or what I found appealing about it, and what. So something like that. Very often now, students who, in their junior year, go off and do an undergraduate research experience. I don't know how many of you have done that. So very often, that kind of experience gives you something to write about from the point of view of research and how much you got into it. Sometimes those research projects aren't very world-shaking, and sometimes they do carry weight. Very often you get a letter of recommendation from the person who was your mentor in the summer. Those can be meaningful letters, yeah?
Business majors are typically expected to do like one or two research projects. Is that normal for math majors to do research?
Well, it's more common than it used to be. There's a lot of REU programs now, and if you're a junior, and this is something you typically do between your junior and senior year, is go off and do one of these. We have some at Purdue this summer, a handful of them. And there's lots of universities that advertise. If you just Google REU and math, you'll find that there's lots of things happening around. And it might be kind of late to apply now if you're a junior, but who knows? There might be opportunities out there. Yeah. Did I see another question? Yes, yeah, so I went to MIT. So I was undergraduate in engineering. I went to MIT. I was fairly advanced in analysis because I'd taken those graduate classes. So I kind of breezed through an analysis, but catching up in algebra was kind of excruciating for me. I took my first algebra class I took at MIT was from Daniel Quillen. I don't know if you heard of him. He won the Fields Medal during the semester he was teaching me that class. And I was not getting it. I went in after the midterm and told him, I think I better drop this class because I'm not getting it. He wouldn't let me drop. But so I stayed in. It was supposed to be a course on general abstract algebra, but he decided he wanted to teach homological algebra, which is the algebra behind algebraic topology. I didn't know any algebraic topology, and so to me, it was pretty much gobbledygook. I worked hard on it, and I could prove the theorems. I just didn't know what they were about. It didn't really grab me very much, but I survived that class. And I kind of had to catch up in abstract algebra on my own. And I may never really have caught up like a person who was properly trained as an undergrad in algebra, in abstract algebra. So if you're a math major, taking a course in abstract algebra, a good one, real analysis that does proofs and uniform convergence and the kind of stuff that we needed in here, so that would be called the basic real analysis. Not, you know, you don't have to go up to measure theory, but sort of just up to measure theory, because measure theory is considered to be a graduate level subject. I did take measure theory as a senior, as an undergrad, and it helped me appreciate analysis and get into it faster as a grad student. Another important class to have is a good course in linear algebra that does proofs if you're going into math. And those are, whoever's looking at your file is going to look very carefully at your transcript. Getting a C here and there as a freshman and sophomore is not such a big deal, especially if it's in history of religion or stuff like that. I see a lot of C's and stuff like that on transcripts. But then when you're a junior and senior and taking the real courses of your major, it's important to have that GPA is looked at distinctly from your general GPA. And so it's important to do well in those subjects. An isolated bad grade can be explained, usually, somehow, but it's important to look good in your major. And especially those three courses is something they're going to look for: real analysis, abstract algebra, and linear algebra. So they're sort of critical for preparation for grad school. By the way, it very often happens that somebody has a bad semester for some reason or another. If something like that happens to you and you think that's going to stick out like a sore thumb on your transcript, I think it's okay to talk about it in your statement of purpose. You know, I had mono that semester and crashed and burned. It happens pretty often, and so you can be pretty sure that whoever's reading your file is going to notice it if it's there. And if you can explain it, it's a wise thing to do. By the way, in math and physics and subjects like that, grad school is free. So basically, all the math PhD students are supported either as teaching assistants, so they get paid to go to graduate school, or they are on some kind of fellowship. The number of people on fellowship is kind of small, but they exist. There's fellowships out there that pays you about the same as being a TA, maybe a little bit more sometimes, because they use fellowships to attract hotshot students to the program. And now there's more fellowships than usual that are targeted for people. The math departments in North America are trying to recruit women to their programs because there's a shortage of women going into math. And so then there's fellowships available that strictly for recruiting underrepresented groups. So we have GAN fellowships that we use for recruiting underrepresented groups. There's very few minorities going into math right now, and it's something we're trying to improve upon. But we also have general fellowships. Some of the fellowships are strictly for U.S. citizens or residents, especially the ones that come from the National Science Foundation. But Purdue has some other fellowships, like the Ross Fellowship, that can get used for international students, where you don't have to be a citizen. And so when you apply to graduate school, you'll automatically be considered for a fellowship. Some of these fancy fellowships that are targeted for underrepresented groups, there might be another essay you have to write called your fellowship essay. And that's an essay that you write that just sort of explains why you're interesting and why you would fit well into the program, you know, what you would bring to the program, in addition to being good at math. It's hard to write unless you've had some major experiences in those areas, but if you want to be considered for all the possible fellowships, you'll have to write that fellowship essay. I've seen lots of fellowships essays. I mean, somebody's, they grew up when their father was in jail or something. And, you know, it makes an interesting, it's like what makes you an interesting person and would make you an unusual student, and you bring something different to the program. So I've seen all kinds of essays that are kind of surprising. And if they're very well done, you say, gee, I want that person here. Because it gives you a feeling they've got potential, and they sort of explain what their struggles have been. But not everybody has an essay like that to write. You're going to get paid to go to grad school to be a TA or be a fellow, and there's something called a tuition waiver. So there might be some fees you have to pay, but you don't have to pay tuition. So you're actually getting paid to go to graduate school. Not everybody realizes that. You don't get paid much. You get paid enough. But if you're married and have a kid or something, you probably, it's at like food stamp level, but you can survive. And so the first couple of years in grad school, you're going to take courses. It's important in the first couple of years of your studies to get sort of a broad foundation for what you're going to concentrate in later. Because later when you write a thesis, you're really going to concentrate in a narrow area of math and work on it full blast to the exclusion of everything else. So your big chance in the beginning to be broad is to take classes. You know, I took classes in topology, algebraic topology, algebra, Fourier analysis. That's when I was taking this class from Kurtzman, where I found my advisor based on the subjects I was studying with him and the way he presented them. So you'd be taking classes, and that you'd be looking out for your potential subject that you want to concentrate in, and a potential advisor. Quite often, they happen at the same time. In a place like Purdue, you know, where there's 5 or 6 people working in, say, complex analysis, maybe almost 10, you can shop around and meet various people and talk to them and figure out who you want to work with, who will match you best. It's important to find the person that sort of matches your personality. I didn't want somebody who was going to sit on me every week and make me come and present every week. Kirsten kind of let me go off and do my own thing for extended periods, and I appreciated that freedom. And he was very supportive. When I did come and talk to him, we had fantastic conversations. And he had tremendous enthusiasm. I would prove a little lemma using Cauchy-Schwarz inequality, and he'd say, "That's fantastic!" He was a crazy Argentinian guy. So. And so, yeah, he was a major part of the good experience I had there. Funny thing is, he was a junior person. So, I mean, it's common that you're attracted to a person who's sort of on fire and a young person doing their own research. That's what Kurtzman was. And he didn't get tenure at MIT, so I had to, he left and I had to continue on my own kind of without him for the last year, which is a bummer, but I managed to finish anyway with him being my advisor, even though he was gone. So that's something to think about when you're choosing an advisor. You can pick somebody old and gray. The worst thing that could happen then is they could drop dead before you're finished. But sometimes these are considerations. If you pick a junior person that doesn't have tenure, they might go away, and you'll have to find either a different area and different advisor. You know, things like that can slow you down. So it's a consideration to take. So after you get this broad base of classes, then the next hurdle is usually something called a qualifier exam, a PhD qualifier exam. At Purdue, that's a series of written exams. At MIT, it was one oral exam on one afternoon. Maybe it's a 2-hour exam, but it was an oral exam. But that is usually a major hurdle, it's something you'll stress over, and that'll be the focus of your life for some time. And then when you pass it, you're a whole different person. Because after that, it's called time to write a thesis. And that's a whole different experience than taking a course. And that's the transition point. I don't think that the qualifier exams aren't meant to kick people out, although some people decide they don't want to do it at that point. You know, they might kind of change their mind about what they want, if they want to do research or not. Because to get ready to do research at that level, takes a full, a real commitment. And that when you're taking the qualifier exam, that much it might be when you realize, oops, I don't want to do that. You don't really know what math research is until you get to that level. So it happens that some people just change their mind and they don't fail that really. They get a master's degree and get a job and leave, rather than, so it's not, I wouldn't call it a failure that, if that's the way it happens. But passing the qual is a big hurdle. Funny thing is, in certain departments now in North America, they're getting rid of the qualifier exams. So they're basing your moving to the next step, like on grades and courses and things like that. So it doesn't it's not this horrific thing that has to happen on one day and you have to pass or you're out. It's not like that anymore. In some places. I don't know what they do. I suppose they still have them at Harvard and MIT. Things are changing a little bit. And once you pass the qualifying exams, then that's when you are supposed to pretty soon have an advisor hooked up and be working on a thesis area. Is there a question?
Yeah, so when you're choosing what school you want to apply to, I know they say only apply to 4 or 5.
Ooh, who says that?
I don't know.
It costs money to apply, so sometimes,
No, they say like maximum 4 or 5. Like,
No, I've known, well, I would just urge you to apply to a range of schools. So I've known people who apply to the top schools and then say, okay, my backup school is going to be Michigan and Wisconsin. It's hard to get into Michigan and Wisconsin. And so they didn't get in anywhere. And they were screwed. And we kept them at Purdue another year in our program just because they were good students who didn't apply to enough places. So if you do want to go to Michigan, if you want to go to Princeton or Harvard, you should apply maybe. But those are long shots because they admit 10 to 15 people a year, and they're very selective. And people who go there usually have maybe even done some research before they get there and are somehow recognizable stars. But to go to Michigan or Wisconsin, then you just have to be very strong and have a solid background. And to go to places like Kentucky or Tennessee, then I would say the demands are considerably less. So I like people to apply to a spectrum of schools where they're going to get guaranteed to get in someplace. And if you're a good student at Purdue, it's a good idea to apply to Purdue as a fallback school. I very often, when I was grad chair, I was writing letters for my students to go away, and I would, if they get in someplace, I would say, yeah, you should go away. But when they didn't get in where they wanted to get in, it was a no-brainer to keep them because I knew them real well. I assume David Goldberg, who's the grad chair here now, can easily talk to people you've had as teachers and decide, make a decision like that. So I'd urge you to apply to Purdue as a fallback.
So when you like choose schools where you want to study, do you like choose them on the basis of the advisor, or do you choose them on the basis of what you want to do?
Yeah, it's the funny thing in math is that you might think you want to do something, but your chances are you're wrong. I thought I wanted to do PDE, and I ended up doing several complex variables. And if I had chosen to go to MIT because several complex variables, I wouldn't, because Kurtzman was the only guy there doing it, and he didn't get tenure there. So at places like Purdue that are big, you have lots of people to choose from. So I don't think I'd make a determination based on what I think I want to do, because those things change very often. And places like Princeton are small and cozy, and the people there are first rate, and they'll get you into a subject area that's fantastic, but you probably don't know what that subject area is. I know there's some physics people in here. I had Zach Sylvan, who was a Purdue undergrad, who was very into math and physics, and was waffling between what he wanted to do. And he applied to physics programs and math programs. And he was a hot shot. He did summer research with me, and I wrote him a very strong letter. He ended up going to Berkeley, which is one of the premier places, but in the math department. And now I looked him up, Googled him, and his thesis is in an area of math that's related to advanced physics, but it's very mathy. It's a very geometric math kind of thing that has connections to symmetry and all the stuff that's hot in physics right now. So he ended up on the math side. But he applied to both kinds of places just in case that he wasn't sure what side of it he wanted to go into. And the same if you're thinking about doing applied math. A lot of departments have both pure and applied math. And so you, if you're thinking, I want to go to, that's one reason maybe to pick a school that has a very strong applied math program, because you think you want to do that. But very often, schools have both. And if, it's maybe, yeah, maybe Harvard doesn't have applied math, but but Princeton has some pretty good applied math going on. Other questions? Yeah.
Do you ever see recommendations from non-professors, like an internship mentor or something?
Yeah, and they don't. I would say they don't carry much weight.
Okay.
They're not negative. Mm-hmm. I suspect sometime that it's somebody's uncle wrote them that letter. I mean, they're usually kind of amusing to read. But if you know, they just say how responsible you are and how brilliant you are, but they don't really know what kind of math you're doing or what you have. Know how it relates to what you're going to concentrate in.
Yeah.
Just as you're responsible. You know, from the sometimes people have teaching and grading experiences in undergrad. Those are good things to have because for international students it's difficult because they need to be very good at speakers of English if they're going to be a TA. But domestic students who have an undergraduate degree from North America. Don't have those problems when it comes to being a TA and the English problems that come from being a full international student trying to be a TA.
Also, I know they require 3 letters of recommendation.
At least 3, right. And so, you can have 4, I think.
Well, so like I have 2 strong letters, but I don't know how to choose a 3rd one. Like, is it okay if I ask an academic advisor?
That would be somebody who has the big picture of your file. I think so, yeah. So the people who talk about what you did in their class, you know, took real analysis and did fantastic, that's an important thing to know. But if your overall transcript is excellent, that's something your advisor could address. I think a more meaningful letter would come from a teacher in math, if you're going into math. The people will be writing letters in the fall, so it could be a class you take in the fall, if you haven't decided what you know, who you want to write. Other questions? Yeah, well, I really enjoyed working with this group. It's been fun. And there's a lot of talent in this room. And when you do go to grad school, let me know where you go. Yeah, okay. Good luck. You're going to Colorado State, you think?
Yeah, I'm really excited.
Uh-huh. What kind of physics are you doing?
They only do 3 tons of physics research there. It's all experimental, but they do AMO, high energy. But I'm looking at AMO. They get a lot of money for that. From the Air Force, actually. So, they have one of the strongest short pulse lasers in the world, and one of the facilities there is.
That's good. Yeah, maybe it's different in physics when you kind of have to know if you're an experimental or physics.
Yeah, unfortunately, like all the research I've done has been theoretical physics, so I'm excited to get into the experimental side as well. Mostly done astrophysics up to this point.
Uh-huh. So. Well, good luck with it. Let me know how it goes.
Yeah, thank you.
I don't use
it that much anyway, so it's fine.
I have done I don't think I have a lot of it, but I tried my best, and I think I really like your teaching.
Oh, thank
I really
you.
Enjoyed that.
Uh-huh.
I think whatever I bought was because of that more than anything else. But thank you for everything.
You're sure you're welcome. Thank you. Thanks for letting me know.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
I'm sorry. I just want to ask. Do you have like a courses about higher dimensional Euclidean space.
Euclidean? You mean like advanced calculus?
I mean like higher dimensional Euclidean space, like 4D or 5D space.
I don't even know what I want to be, honestly.
The basic real analysis gets done in higher dimensions. So the real analysis, like measure theory, can be done in Rn. And the Fourier analysis can be done in Rn also. There's a Fourier transform in Rn. Once you understand the one-dimensional version, you can start to understand the n-dimensional version. But then the courses would be graduate courses. And the next step after finite dimensional would be infinite dimensional. So that would be Hilbert space and stuff like that. So those are graduate level courses. So real analysis and measure theory, functional analysis. Differential geometry is very much the n-dimensional analysis. And once you do it on Rn, then you patch it together and do it on manifolds.
This guy wasn't able to prove this theorem.
Differential geometry will have to do with Rn and how to extend it to more geometric things.
Differential geometry.
That's exactly what he's doing.
So yeah, the foundation for differential geometry is the calculus of Rn, the differential forms and things like that.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, if you want your phone,
maybe you'll
have to take it. Thanks for everything, Professor.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Have a great summer.
You too.
For computer science, so I was going to apply for computer science. Uh-huh. The problem is all the computer science classes have been like huge.
Oh really?
Yeah, like I haven't had any class that's under like.
Well, I imagine
60. I guess
being a hotshot math student is a plus for a computer science major.
Okay.
So if your grades are good in computer science, I would think that a letter from a math professor would carry a similar weight.
Okay.
So you're going to be a senior next year?
Yeah, so I'll apply next year.
What if you get to know somebody over there?
Well, because there's one professor I've had 3 times for algorithms.
Who's that?
Frederickson.
Frederickson. I was going to say, go talk to him.
Yeah, yeah. I have, but he's retiring at the end
he's
of this
retiring
year.
Right now.
Is that?
Yeah.
Like,
well, I think he'll still be around and talk to you.
Okay.
He seems like a reasonable person to write a letter.
Yeah, because he's
especially
the only
if he
one.
Knows you.
Yeah.
If he knows you at a... If he noticed you out of the horde of students he had, he can say nice things about you.
Yeah.
And he's he's been the grad chair over there too, so he sort of knows what to recognize in a student who will be successful. And he knows how to write a letter.
Okay.
So one from him and a couple, and you could have a math professor or two.
Yeah, because I also did a couple of ECE courses, so I knew a professor there. So I was going to do one CS, one math, and one ECE.
I think that's a good plan. And I would think that the math letter would carry weight.
Okay. Yeah, because if he retires, is he still going to be around?
I think so. Right? I don't think his wife is retiring, and she's in the department.
Yeah, she is too.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I guess I'll have to ask him.
Yeah, I think he'd be a good choice.
Okay. Yeah, because the other
and, you know, go in and talk to him about your interests and would be worthwhile, especially now he's got time on his hands.
Yeah.
Because it's nice that he could have something personal to say about you.
Okay.
I like to, if I had students come to my office hours and talk about questions and, you know, I get to know them well, that makes my letter stronger and more meaningful.
Yeah. Okay. Because, I don't know. Because internships in CS, like, because math people do like REUs, but in CS they do like internships more.
Well,
so
maybe in CS probably, those letters would be meaningful.
Okay, I was
especially if you did something, you know, say we gave you this project and you nailed it, and, you know, because
it's more, it was
saved
like,
us millions of dollars.
Yeah, well, it was. It's because it's not like a university thing; it's from like a company.
Well, it depends on what you're being trained for. You know? In math, we're training people to do research and sort of be like us. In CS, they might be training people to go out and do stuff. And if you went out and did something, that's a good thing.
Okay. Yeah.
You can always change your mind and go into math.
I could. No, I've been thinking about that because I don't know.
Well, there's very mathy areas of computer science. And in fact, there's people in our department who are more in math. Their partial appointment is math and CS, and their majority is in math. And they're Man, they could be either or.
I'm a double major.
Are you?
I'm doing a double major.